recording this is. Okay. All right. So, identify yourself for the recording.
Ethan Buckler. Is that too loud?
No, that's good. That's good. Okay. Yeah, we're interviewing Ethan at the Uptown Cafe in Louisville. It's October. Is it the 22nd? I think it is.
It's the 23rd.
23rd. October 23rd. I lost today. 2016.
I know that because tomorrow's my birthday. So.
Okay. Happy birthday. How old?
49.
Oh, all right. Young man. Okay. This is Chip Noll conducting the interview. Okay. So a lot of this is going to be background information, then we'll get to specific stuff about the bands you've been in and all. When and where were you born?
I was born in Bennington, Vermont in 1967.
Okay.
October 24th.
All right. When did your family come to Louisville?
When I was 1 year old.
Okay. All right. And so where did you go to school?
To grade school, I went to St. Stephen's, and then I went to St. Francis High School.
Okay. All right.
For a few years, I went to St. Francis Goshen also.
Okay. All right. All right. What did your parents do for a living?
My mom is a college professor, and my dad is wrote for the Courier Journal.
Okay. What is your mom's dark discipline?
English composition.
Okay. All right. I know that. Is her last name Buckler? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
They're still together. They live in suburban Chicago.
Oh. Okay. I didn't realize that. All right. Okay. So how did you get interested in music?
I started getting interested in music. Well, I always liked music. But I think when I got interested in playing music is probably when I went to high school with David Pajo, and he started showing me how to play bass and guitar.
Okay.
And I joined a band shortly thereafter.
Which band was that?
Generic Reality.
Okay.
A high school punk band.
Okay. So what year would that have been?
Oh, like I'd say 84.
Okay. All right. Well, let's go back first. I mean, not just playing music, but just, you know, when did you start listening to music and getting really intensely interested in it, even before you started playing?
Probably I used to like disco a lot. Like, I go roller skating in fifth grade.
Okay.
And I really liked the disco music, like the Knack and Blondie.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, so tell me about
Barry Manilow. Okay. Barry Manilow.
All right. So tell me about Generic Reality.
Mm-hmm. It's a very a simple punk band. I played bass, and they showed me how to play the bass to play those songs. Probably really what got me started.
Was Pajo in that too?
No, that was Mohawk Dave, who passed away a few years ago.
Mohawk Dave.
Dave Hughes.
Okay.
And John Hawkins and Perry Joyner.
Okay. All right. Do you remember? What do you remember about that? What do you remember about?
We played very simple songs, like beginner level songs.
Okay. Well, so
you know, like House of the Rising Sun, or you know, I forget what else we played.
Like Speed It Up, or
You know, like punk rock style, like Iron Man.
That's good.
Those kind of songs.
Okay. Well, so was there any? I mean, some people getting into punk rock, I think, I mean, it's almost like a conversion experience because it wasn't mainstream, right?
Right.
I mean, did you have that, or was it more seamless just because of people that you knew?
When I found out about punk rock, it's when I started going to a private school. And the private school, the kids were already into punk rock, like the Dead Kennedys.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I found that real repulsive, those bands. And then when I got into high school, there was another, they had a band play there, Languid and Flaccid.
Sure.
And then from there, I started getting much more interested in it.
Okay. What was it about Languid and Flaccid that appealed to you?
Well, that there was some little kids that could figure out how to play in a band together. And then and the idea of and I saw Your Food, and just the kids in my neighborhood were more into rock and roll music, you know, and I wanted to distinguish myself from them and mm-hmm. find a new identity. And MTV was, you know, that was when the beginning of MTV, so
that's
I like, you know, the fashion and the style, and you get you know, you dress up like that, you get more attention.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So, all right, so you started, your beginning of your involvement in the Louisville scene would be seeing some of those early bands,
mm-hmm.
like Languid and Flaccid, mm-hmm. Your Food, anything.
I never saw Babylon Dance Band. I was a little bit too young for Babylon Dance Band.
Okay.
But yeah, definitely Languid and Flaccid and Your Food were those first local bands I saw. Okay.
And you mentioned...
And it was a little bit of a freak show, because, you know, it was like, look at those guys, look at those people.
And yeah.
There's a little bit of that, but it's...
Sure, sure.
But it was also, it looked like they were having a lot of fun, it was funny.
Yeah. All right. You talked a little bit, but, you know, I mean, in what ways did the music seem different? The music and the people seem different from what you experienced before.
Well, I was too young to be... I know a lot of people that got into punk rock were sort of like rock and rollers, and they didn't like... They thought that rock and roll got too institutionalized.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like in the 70s, sort of like the hippie style.
Sure.
Became just like everybody sort of looked like a hippie, and everybody listened to rock and roll.
Right.
And
right.
so some people wanted to... find something a little bit more intense, and they got in the punk rock happened. And for me, I was too young to go through that so much. So go back to your question. What was your question?
Well, I guess it was just, in what ways did the music seem different? The music and the people
uh-huh.
in the scene seemed different from
what you're... Yeah, I didn't have a whole lot to compare it to, is what I was...
Okay.
Was getting ready to say. So I would say that the there was a I remember the dancing when I see those punk bands, and they dance much more spastically.
Right. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
You know, if I saw some ordinary band like at the school, like a high school prom type of band, that'd be the comparison.
Right. Okay.
Nobody was dancing like that.
All right.
They weren't slam dancing, or there's no mosh pit.
Right, right. Okay,
it was much more like breeders oriented, you know. It's for like couples and stuff.
Right.
As opposed to the mosh pit was much more just letting it go.
Yeah.
You know, it was more cathartic, more fun.
Okay.
You know, just like itching to jump into it.
Did you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
It's like playing basketball or something. If you feel hyperactive, it's definitely something to do.
Okay. So after Generic Reality, what happened after that as far as as the bands you were in?
After that, I played in another band called Dot 39, and that was also like a punk band. Maybe it was a little bit more tighter. We practiced more.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what? How would you describe it besides... another punk band that was tighter? I mean, what do you remember?
It sounded more like Minor Threat
uh-huh.
as opposed to the Sex Pistols.
Okay.
I would say.
Who all was in that?
That also had John Hawkins, a guy, Bill Heideman, who's a drummer.
Okay.
And, Woody Delaney.
Okay.
Especially just people.
Is that Woody Delaney is Woodrow on the radio? Is that right?
No, Woody.
That's a different Woody. Okay. That name's really familiar. Okay.
He's around. He's a nice guy. He also went to high school with those other guys.
Okay. And so what were the venues that you were seeing music in?
Mostly at either house parties. A lot of them were at house parties. Schools like St. Francis School that would have let punk bands play there. Or all ages shows.
Like did Tullians do all ages shows? I can't remember.
Not much. They might have.
Okay.
But I don't remember any all ages shows at Tullians.
Maybe
they had them at the Douglas Community Center.
Okay. All right. Okay. So, what was I going to say? So, how did your participation in the scene and the music fit in or not fit in with the rest of your life? When you're a teenager, you're going to school and all the rest of it.
Right. Well, it totally changed my life because I didn't really have a lot of friends. And then all of a sudden when I started playing in bands, you know, then you have a group of friends. You know, everybody goes through that conversion in high school where they like, they sort of find their identity and they figure out where they belong. And for me, that was definitely had to do with playing in bands and being in the alternative music world.
Okay. All right. So there's Dot 39 then.
Yeah, before that, all I did was play basketball.
Okay. All right.
That was my whole life. You know, my whole social life. No, not really. But that was my whole social life was playing basketball around the neighborhood.
Yeah, sure.
And then suddenly you find something that where you click with other people that are like you. And
what was your neighborhood?
Audubon Park.
Okay. All right. Okay, so then just keep going with the progress of your musical career.
Okay, then after high school, the next band I was in was Slint, the one that everybody's knows about.
Okay.
And that was like freshman year in college.
Okay. Where were you going to college?
U of L.
Okay. So talk about that. How did that get together? And sort of what was the idea when you got it together?
Well, I was already getting tired of hardcore style music. It's too loud, and then and Dave Pajo, who's still friends with, he was already playing in another band with Britt called Maurice.
Okay.
And I was told him that I wanted to start a new kind of band that was maybe more, I was thinking like something psychedelic or, I was tired of the hardcore. I wanted to do something maybe a little bit more groovy for sure.
Well, when you say psychedelic, what did you have anything in mind?
Yeah, like more like hippie music, like Led Zeppelin or, I started liking music, that you could smoke pot to kind of music.
Okay. So
as opposed to like, running around and mosh pitting, I wanted something more like hanging out and sitting around with your friends kind of music.
Okay. All right, that makes sense.
And that happened when I was about 19.
Okay. All right.
So and then, I wanted something where I could play like a groovy bass. I was tired of playing the bass exactly like what was played on the guitar in a punk band.
Right.
I wanted to have like a real bass line.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was sort of like, and then I started talking to Britt, and we decided to do Slint. And that was the idea.
So how do you know Britt?
I knew Britt just around from him playing in Maurice. Okay. I used to go to watch Maurice have practice.
Okay. All right.
When they practice, it was sort of like people would come over and watch practice.
All right. Did they practice at the Walfords too?
Maurice, yeah.
Okay.
They had a soundproof basement. And
well, at the same time that Slink got going, Britt was drumming in the Bulls with me, so we alternated nights with you guys.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, I know that basement real well.
Right.
All right, so you had this idea you wanted to do more music to listen to, music to smoke pot to, and then, so you get together with Pajo, Britt, and was Brian in it at the beginning? Or?
First it was me and Pajo and Britt, and then we invited Brian. And we actually talked about having Will sing too.
Will Oldham?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Why did that not?
I don't remember exactly why, but it turned out that I guess we decided not to have Will sing. But we were knocking that around for a bit.
Okay. All right. So tell me about the development of that band.
Slint. So we did, I guess I was in Slint for the first year.
Mm-hmm.
And we played, and I used to hang around with Britt all the time.
Yeah. Describe Britt. This guy, that's part of it, is to tell about the people who were.
Okay. Well, Britt was very, he's younger than I was. He's still in high school. He's very precocious teenager.
Yeah.
He already had a serious girlfriend, and his musical abilities were very advanced. He could be very serious and focus on stuff for a long time compared to other, 14-year-olds.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he's a real impressive specimen.
Okay.
Right. He was a fantastic drummer, and he also played classical piano.
Okay. All right.
And he wanted to put together these real complicated songs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's kind of more of a math metal
mm-hmm.
style, and then Slint was somewhat math metal, maybe a little bit more jazzy sounding.
Mm-hmm.
I think he wanted to do stuff that sounded like the Meat Puppets who's that band that had the big guy that died in a car? The Minutemen, with the jangly guitars.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yeah, kind of a jazz influence.
That was the '80s. The jangly guitar was starting to become really popular in the early '80s.
Yeah. Okay.
We liked the jangly guitar music a little bit.
Okay. All right.
I think everybody was tired of like the loud walla sound music. It seemed like everybody was looking for something to do besides that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like it all got more and more hardcore and more hardcore, and then you just get to the point where you can't get any more hardcore.
Right, right.
So you have to sort of back up.
Well, was there
Britt was very talented and very, he seemed like well past his years and his maturity level.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. I have a great question to ask.
Okay.
Well, tell me about the other members of Slint. Tell me about Paho. Tell me about Brian.
Paho was kind of like he's actually like a hair metal guitar player. He's already playing in a cover band.
Mm-hmm.
And he's real advanced for his age, kind of like Britt. But he played like that. He played in that. Like a hair metal band that was had a booking agency, and they played like high school dances.
Uh huh. Okay.
And played hair songs, and then he switched over to being into hardcore punk rock.
Mm-hmm.
And then Brian was also in Languid and Flaccid, and he'd been playing in bands since he was like 11 years old.
Right. Right. Okay. Well, just was there anybody on the local scene that you would say was like an influence or somebody you looked up to?
Definitely Malignant Growth and Fading Out.
Okay. I'm like, why is that?
I just love, they're one of the local bands that I listen to as if I was listening to, a famous band.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I listen to their demo tape over and over again.
Okay.
I thought it was just really exciting. I really enjoyed the, there's different kinds of music that does different things, but I really like the energy music
mm-hmm.
that makes you feel feeling, and Malignant Growth was great. A lot of the early King Kong songs I wrote was kind of, I like this kind of like riffy music.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of riffy music, but Malignant Growth was, and Fading Out was way better than the rest.
Okay, all right.
And Brett Ralph, great singer.
Yeah.
It's really fun.
Yeah. Okay.
I was really proud that there'd be a band like that in my hometown.
Mm-hmm.
Because I used to see a lot of bands, but they were really especially great.
Yeah. Yeah, they really were. Okay. All right. So then...
I never saw the Babylon Dance Band back then. Cause
yeah.
I came along. I was almost came along too late for Malignant Growth. I think I saw them once.
Okay. All right. So you start Slint,
mm-hmm.
and are you playing out very much?
When I was in it, we played 6 shows, I think. And I think we had about 6 songs to play. And we practiced all the time. We were a big practicing band.
How often would you say?
seemed like we were practicing every day for a while.
Okay. All right. For how long?
You know, a couple hours.
Okay. All right. All right. So then you recorded that first album.
Yeah. At the end of that year, we recorded that album.
Okay. So talk about the experience of that. I know.
Everybody knows all about it. So then I didn't like the way the album came out at the time, and I threw a hissy fit and I quit the band.
Okay. Well, how do you, I mean, obviously that has been in a lot of stuff and all that, but I mean, I'm just wondering how do you look back on it now? Do you still?
Well, if I stayed in Slint, I would definitely be more rich for sure.
I mean, but do you still feel like you were right? I mean, that you were right about the way that you did. I mean, the story I've always heard is that you really disliked the production of the album and the album, the music did not have, I mean, the term I always saw was delicacy.
Right.
That, yeah.
Yeah, the way I was expecting it to sound when we recorded it, it didn't sound anything like it.
Okay.
It had more the big black Steve Albini sound.
Which you describe as?
Yeah, it was more like harsh and, you know, had that sort of metallic kind of production. And I didn't know very much about production when I was 19. And I probably, if I went through that now, I probably would have just went along with it. Because mm-hmm. I know that there's always another chance and there'll always be another album or whatever.
Right.
But when I was 19, I thought, I spent a whole year making this, and this is what we get, and I thought it was a big, big disaster, and I didn't want to be in the band anymore.
Okay.
And they did a lot of those overdubs, where they said sort of obnoxious words.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we named all the songs after renamed all the songs after our parents.
Uh-huh. What were the original names, like?
Because we didn't have names.
Oh, I see.
They were mostly instrumental songs. We didn't really have lyrics.
Right.
So once we got to the studio, we sort of threw all that stuff on there. With Steve Albini's help.
Mm-hmm.
And it had that kind of sound, that real, the kind of, and when I listen to it now, it sounds fine, you know, production-wise.
Right.
I mean, actually, it's actually fine, but it doesn't sound like what I thought it should have sounded like.
Right.
And I thought that Steve Albini, all the bands that recorded with Steve Albini all had the same sound.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seemed like a big racket. And I thought we got like already sucked up into this racket.
Uh-huh.
And then we have to go around being, you know, yet another Steve Albini band.
Right. Okay.
And I just didn't think that was very inspiring. And that, and I got mad and I quit.
So, I mean, how did that, I mean, was that a big argument? I mean, I think, like the first Slint stuff, right? I mean, the first King Kong stuff, didn't they play with you, I thought? Like,
yeah, they helped me.
So well, then I guess what I'm asking is...
Yeah, first I told them I would stay in Slint if they did it the way I wanted. If we I wanted to re-record the whole album without Steve Albini, and there's no way they were going to do that.
Right.
And I said, well, I'll start my own band, and I'll call it King Kong. And then my idea was I was going to show how I thought it should sound, and I'll just have my own band.
Mm-hmm. I guess what I was getting at was that it seems like while you were mad and you quit the band,
we still managed to make a single and stuff.
Right. And it seemed like maybe it didn't break relationships, or did it?
No, not really.
Okay. All right. Well, so you start King Kong, which has been your vehicle from that time to this. What was your idea when you started out?
I really wanted to do I like the blues, like the West End blues. We started going to juke joints in the West End.
Mm-hmm. Like where?
Like the Pleasure Inn.
And that was where?
It's on 7th.
Okay.
It's like 7th and Hill Street. And I went to 26th Street, which is 26th and Garland.
Okay.
And so I thought that was what I really wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was groovy and it was easy to dance to, and it was more, the songs weren't complicated. you know, anybody, you know, it's very expressive and emotional.
How did, I mean, I've just got to ask, you know, white kid going to West End bars, how did that go? Was it, did you ever feel uncomfortable or have any?
No. It was a, I think they were used to it. I mean, it was a group of, like, white 19-year-olds walking in there, and I think they'd all seen that before.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So, all right, so, okay, so the blues became the thing for you, and
And I wanted to do something much more simple. Like, I really wanted to break it. Slint had a tendency to get too complicated. And so, and then all the band before that, Dot 39, I thought, like, we let that get too complicated, too.
Okay. All right.
And I really, really wanted to see if I could get music down to a much more simple and basic. And just, you know, get rid of the complicated stuff. And I thought that the blues, you know, it was like a kind of a concept was the blues. And I thought that that was a really good simplified way to make a song.
When it strikes me, I mean, just thinking back on it, not much of a blues influence in the Louisville music, in the Louisville underground music scene up to that point, right? I mean, I can't really think of anybody who, you know.
Well, if you take a pop song.
Right.
And you sort of like turn it inside out, it basically is a blues song.
Right. Oh, sure. I mean, it all comes from
like
that.
A pop song goes like 1, 2, and then 5, and then back to 1.
Right.
But if you make the 5 into the 1, then the 2, or you make the 5 and the 4, then the 2 becomes the 5. You know, it's just like an inside out blues song.
Right. Right. Well, so.
I know what you mean. Well, you know, the whole hippie music, rock and roll and stuff was like that.
Right.
But that already been done.
Right, right. But, yeah, so it struck me that you were doing kind of an unusual take on the blues, you know, a personal take. I mean, I don't know if you saw it that way or if it was just, this is what happens when I, Ethan Buckler, decide to play the blues. But can't hear the nod. Did you? Is that a yes?
Yeah, that's just what Ethan Buckler, what happens when Ethan Buckler decides he's going to play the blues. And also, it was real, like, the guy that recorded the Slint, Steve Albini, they really hated like hippie music and anything that sounded like hippie music. So I intentionally wanted to do something that sounds like hippie music to go against what they were into. Like, I was trying really hard to get on the outs with that.
Okay, sure, sure.
If they're going to be, like, anti-hippie music, then I'll be anti-anti-hippie music.
Okay. All right, so... my eyes are worse than they should be. Anyway. Okay, so, I mean,
it wasn't hippie music, but... Right. That wasn't what they... You know, there's a lot of... Like, in the 80s, there's a big blues revival.
Oh, was it? I mean, I'm trying to...
With the Blues Brothers, and there were a lot of these like white guy blues bands.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it was like the older crowd for us, and then so the Steve Albini crowd really hated that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And most of it was really bad, like the kind of like. Anytime you go to a bar back then, there'd be some kind of blues band like that. So, are you waiting for us to get in here?
Oh, no.
Oh, okay. 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 And then, so they had those kind of bands, and I thought it was funny to break their mode of what mold. The Steve Albini was trying to break.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, so I'm curious. I mean,
I put an organ on the first single.
Uh-huh.
A little organ. But for those people, any kind of organ is really bad. That's really against the rules.
Oh, is that?
You know, they had all these little rules that you had to follow to be part of the club.
Right, right.
So I put an organ on it just to make sure to break their rules.
Okay. What about, I mean, you had a particular, seems to me, like, lyric writing style. I don't know if you thought about it in that way, but, I mean, what was, you know, it was a very simple kind of, in some ways, a naive style, kinda, uh-huh. right? I mean, I assume that's intentional and that you're not just a savant, right?
Right.
Right. How did you come to that? What was appealing in working in that way?
Well, one of the things that I thought about these bands that a lot of people were having trouble with is lyrics. Like, you always had these music is a very technical thing, and right. it attracts these kind of like technical thinking people.
Right.
And it's fun to like play, you know, write riffs on guitar and whatnot. And then it comes time to think of some lyrics. And everybody, they would get mad if somebody was too much of a show-off, kind of like a singer show-off. So I was trying really hard to make the lyrics more presentable and upfront.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And a lot of people would say, oh, lyrics don't matter, singing doesn't matter. But really, when most people listen to music, that's what they listen to, is the singing and the lyrics.
Right, right.
So I was just like, you know, I just did free association. Mm-hmm. I tried to make it rhyme. Right. A lot of people were intentionally writing lyrics that don't rhyme.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd make them rhyme. I really tried to focus on making it more rhythmic with like blues lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
Like
mm-hmm.
rap, as you know, rap was really big back then.
Right.
And so I was trying to had more like rhythmic patterns. And I really wanted to have a lot of visuals.
What do you mean a lot of visuals?
Like talk about something that you see.
Oh, okay.
And not have it just be a bunch of random stuff that a lot of song lyrics I thought would just sound like really random, but it didn't really make any sense.
Okay.
So I tried to at least have the lyrics, you know, like come to a point. And so maybe they sound a little goofy and simplistic.
But yeah, but I mean, but you're right. It's right. It's a clear image.
Right. But I was really trying to let go and just be myself. And, you know, just and not be embarrassed about mm-hmm. whatever lyrics, because lyrics are the most revealing part of music. I mean, when you're doing instrumentation or production, you kind of get to hide behind all the gear. You know, lyrics are really the most revealing.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you most naked, so people get it. It's real easy to feel uncomfortable about singing and what your lyrics say, and expressing your emotions.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
that was tougher for people my age, say, than like, you know, like. Say like the Jim Morrison type of generation, I think. But a lot of people my age had a real hard time, you know, opening themselves up.
Mm-hmm. I could see that, yeah. I mean,
that's why there's so many instrumental bands.
Yeah. 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 Okay. So, all right. So you start, you do a single, and how soon did King Kong start playing out?
We played, I sort of set it up kind of like a political campaign. I used to work at a Ralph Nader's office.
Uh-huh.
In Washington, D.C. I used to go back and forth.
Okay.
And so I sort of did it like I did a, like I put out the album and I set up shows and I sort of did it all at once. Like a little press release. And,
okay.
You know, I did it like a publicity.
Okay. What were you doing at Nader's office?
My aunt was friends with Ralph Nader, so she got me a job up there. You know, I was just like making coffee and
right.
printing files and or filing stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I saw how they would come up with like they set up like the way they push like a political thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay. If somebody released a book, then they would right. do press releases and that kind of stuff.
Right.
So set up for the book, and then they go out and do interviews. And
okay, so you wanted to have a product.
I saw how that media that media thing was set up, so I sort of did it in, like, a miniature version. And I got my dad to pay to have, like, 1,000 records printed.
Okay.
And so, but I released the album, then set up a bunch of shows, and did set up some interviews. And
mm-hmm.
So I had it all happen at the same time.
Okay. All right. So... And so when you played out then, who was in the band?
Then, of course, the Slint guys didn't do the band. Right. And then they went back and did Slint again.
Right.
Because Slint broke up for a while during my hissy fit. But eventually they went back to it. And then, so I got Darren Rappa was the bass player. Rich Sewer was a drummer. Okay. And neither of them had a lot of experience playing in bands. So I was going to just teach them how to do it. You know, just, you know, plant the seed.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't going to go to the nursery and get a sapling. I was going to plant the seed. Okay. So I got those guys started. Okay. You know, I'd already been in a bunch of bands by that time, so.
Yeah.
I wanted to show them how to do it.
Well, and then Darren ended up in a bunch of bands, right? Am I right or wrong?
He ended up singing, in a band here, Verktum.
Okay. Right. And then, but Rich really did, not.
Rich played with some other bands.
Oh, did he?
I think he played with Squirrel Bait for a little while.
Okay. All right. So, well, that would have been before this, right?
But his drumming was real enthusiastic, but he wasn't polished at all.
Right. Okay. All right. So, then just take the story forward. What's happening for, and this would have been, when would this have been?
Like in the late 80s.
Yeah, okay. All right. So, moving forward, what happens with King Kong? How does it change? How does it develop? What are you?
I had no intention that I'd still be doing King Kong by the time I'm 50. That was not the plan at all. Yeah. But it just sort of caught fire and it just became my thing and I never heard the end of it. And I've tried to stop doing it a few times, but it's always just like that's how I'm known for is King Kong.
Right, right, and so you're still doing the videos and
right,
and I know you play
writing
some,
songs.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the one thing I'm good at doing is for me at least, that's the one thing I'm better at than doing anything else is writing songs.
Mm-hmm.
And I still like to write songs. In King Kong, we don't tour or play as much anymore. We're not on a record label anymore that we were on for a long time.
Right, that was Drag City.
Drag City.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so I'm just curious, you know, how, you know, sort of what are the steps along the way, right? I mean, am I right? There was the first album was Old Man on the Bridge, right?
We did a couple singles.
Right.
Then the guy that I was friends with, who I met in Washington, D.C., got a job being the president of Homestead Records.
Okay. Who was that?
Ken Kacken.
Okay. I didn't realize. Okay. I mixed up on my timeline.
And then he also put out Antietam, I think.
Yeah,
on Homestead.
Yeah, no,
and
great,
so
great guy.
And he lives in Cincinnati now. So we made an album, our first album on Homestead. Then I let Brian be the producer of the record, and Dave Pajo did the artwork.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, when we put out that album, and we went on tour, and then. And then I was doing an interview with Lisa Suckdog. You know who Lisa Suckdog is?
I know who she is, yeah.
She did an interview. And then I talked from there. I got to talk to her boyfriend who was already on Drag City. Drag City was just a little bitty record label in this guy's apartment in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
And then he asked me if I wanted to do an album with Drag City.
Who was his name?
Dan Koretsky.
Okay.
So I guess our next five albums, we put out five albums on Drag City.
Okay, all right. So how did the band change over, or did it? I mean, it seems like you sort of did different things along the way.
Yeah, I always like to experiment. I always like to do some, you know, every song is I try to do something I hadn't done before.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like either a new chord, if I learn a new chord, or a new something.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I added a female singer to a lot of songs because I thought my voice was really flat. I don't have much range and I could barely sing. So I thought if people got tired of my voice, I'd have this girl with a real wide range sing along too.
And
that kind of caused us to sound like the B-52s a little bit.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of people compare us to the B-52s.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because I never thought about it, but then I saw that comparison somewhere.
Yeah.
And I thought, I can hear that. You know, but yeah. I mean, was that anybody that you ever really?
Oh, I love the B-52s. Yeah. But I didn't expect us to sound. People to compare us to the B-52s. People almost thought we should dress up like the B-52s and be a B-52s ripoff band. It was almost that much.
That's funny.
I heard about it a lot.
So who was the female singer?
Amy. Amy Ritchie.
Okay. So it's always been Amy.
Yeah.
Okay. Because yeah, I guess she's Amy George on the early out.
That was a mistake.
Oh, that was a mistake.
There's another woman named Amy George. And when Rich was doing this is before it, computers, and he's doing the artwork, and he accidentally wrote Amy George.
Okay. All right. I wondered about that. Yeah.
Who looks a little bit like Amy.
Oh, the
okay. She's kind of a similar looking person.
Okay. All right. Yeah, Amy's great. Okay, so...
But we didn't have computers to fix it, and once it went out, we had to wait till the next pressing before they could fix it.
Okay. All right. So, one thing I was going to think probably precedes this historically, I seem to recall that you, at one point, took lessons from Smoketown Red.
Yeah.
Is that right? Talk about that. Well, let's explain who he is.
Okay, the guy that really got me into liking the blues was Smoketown Red. And it was not like, it wasn't just like hearing the blues. When he played it, he could take the most boring, mundane blues song, and he could just bring it to life. And he's a guitar player. Okay. And he could just play circles around any song. And he made it seem so easy, and I just liked his, I just really liked his style. He would show up, the band would already be playing, and he'd just walk in with his little bitty guitar amp. He didn't have a Marshall stack, and he just had like a cheap guitar from the doo-wop shop.
Uh-huh.
You know, he didn't even have a Fender, and he would plug in, and he would, at first it was real quiet, and you could barely hear him, and then he'd just start, you know, with his eyes closed, and he'd start finding the flow of the music. And the other guitar player played with a wah-wah pedal.
Mm-hmm.
So it had a real amorphous sound. You know, you say his music is a balance between melody and harmony. So the other guitar player is very melodic. And then Smoketown was real syncopated and real chorded.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So Henry was the melody and Smoketown was the harmony, and the two things just fit in perfectly together.
I mean, you actually took lessons from him, right?
Right. So then I talked to him, and I asked him if he ever wanted to get together, and he's real talkative. He's an albino black guy, and I asked him if he ever wanted to get together and show me some stuff. And he's like, yeah, come on over to my place. I'll show you. Maybe we could play in a band together. I was like, are you kidding me? And I couldn't wait to go over there.
Yeah.
And so I guess...
So talk about it, yeah.
I went over there almost every day for about a year.
Where do you live?
In the 18th, or he lived at, yeah. Is it? Yeah, 18th and Broadway, I think.
Okay.
And we go over there and drink coffee, and then he wanted to teach me how to play the bass, because he wanted to start a band and have me play the bass. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, okay, I'll learn how to play the bass. But, and he showed me how to play, like, blues, and he was a little bit, like, post-blues, he's maybe more funky.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those guys that didn't really like, they really didn't like the kind of down-home blues as a little bit the older.
Mm-hmm.
He's probably, maybe he's in his 50s at that time.
Right.
And Henry was in his 70s, and Henry was like blues.
Right.
So maybe Smoketown was a little bit more, and he could play that kind of blues, but he said he really didn't like it. He really liked stuff like... Stevie Wonder and Prince,
okay.
And the Beatles. He just liked music, period.
Okay.
And he wasn't stuck on some kind of blues thing.
Right.
And maybe he thought blues was a little bit like too, you know, too low class or too like too slavey.
Uh huh.
And he liked the more slicker style.
Okay.
But it was the same basic idea. So right. He showed me how to play the bass, but it was more of a funky style of bass.
Uh huh. Okay.
And so, more or less, King Kong adapted the Smoketown. He had his, you know, kind of theory and style of playing. I kind of made King Kong adapt. That's where I got sort of like the backbone of it, you know, the Smoketown Red way.
Okay. But he never played in King Kong, did he?
A couple times, yeah. For a while, he wanted to play in King Kong. And I think we did play a couple shows where he played. And on the back of the first King Kong album, Old Man on the Bridge, he's actually in the picture, but we like cut the picture. We had to crop the picture so you couldn't see him in the picture.
Okay.
Because he didn't play on the album. But yeah, he wanted to play, and you know, he's a character. He wanted to get me some white girls. Uh-huh. You want me to take him meet some white girls and stuff. You know, he's like, he dressed up like a pimp.
Okay. And did he die? Am I right? Or
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I know he's...
You lost contact with
him? I haven't talked to him in a while. I talked to his uncle or his nephew a few years ago, and he said that he was in poor health.
Okay.
But he didn't know for sure what was going on.
I must have taken out somebody.
So he's probably about 80.
Okay.
By now.
All right. Well, let's just talk. I mean, I don't know what else I'm willing to hear in any degree of detail that you want to lay it out.
Uh-huh.
Sort of, you know, the progress of the music that you made.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you seem to sort of want to talk about it more generally, and that's fine.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know if there's any other story to tell about the way you think it changed over the years, the people who came in and changed the band differently, or any of it.
Yeah. Whenever, when I write, I still like to write songs, but now I do it for videos.
Right.
And I like doing creative stuff, and I like to write stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's my main thing. I don't have to be playing in a band, and I don't have to go on tour, and I don't have to be famous, but I just like to make up. I like to explore the new thing.
Okay.
Like with Slint, I wanted Slint to be I wanted us to be forward from what everybody else was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like that with King Kong, and I still like to do that with videos. Like when King Kong plays, we're just playing usually the same old songs that we've always played. But I always want to have some project where I'm trying to discover the next thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, was there ever a point where King Kong was really a living for you?
Maybe for a couple years. I got some pretty good checks.
Mm-hmm.
But I always had to have some kind of part-time job.
Right, right, right. As does every musician.
I never really cashed in a big way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can I ask this question?
I mean, I've had better moments than most, but you know, I still work here. I have to work somewhere.
Yeah, right, right.
The next thing is I want to do videos.
Yeah.
I think that, looking forward, I don't think that bands, that we think of as bands, is going to be happening forever.
Uh-huh.
I feel like it's in decline.
Okay.
The idea of somebody playing the drums with a guitar player, those kind of bands, the rock band.
Yeah.
I don't think that's what's going to be happening anymore.
Well, so okay, so you've made.
I don't think there's the romance or the.
Uh huh.
I don't think they have like the power of influence that they used to at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because bands really like we're like identification things. You know, people that listen to The Who, when you were in high school, you know who listened to The Who, and you know who listened to whatever.
Right.
And they don't seem to have that kind of influence anymore, at all. But there's always going to be music, and there's always going to be communications.
Right. We'll talk about the videos.
So that's why I want to do videos. Yeah. I can make the music on a computer. I don't need a record label. I have a friend that helps me do the videos. It's a lot easier to do a video than it used to be with digital.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can put them on, and I want them to tell us, like, the whole idea of telling a simple story, just like I do with King Kong, but I just want to have a simple video that goes with it. And then anybody could watch it on their phone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you've made how many?
Two. Okay. And I'm working on a third one.
Okay.
It takes a long time to make one video.
Yeah.
I mean, I could write songs all day long, but, you know, getting the whole video together is hard.
How,
But it's the same, yeah. like a video is very much like a song, you know. You know, it has the same kind of formula as a song, I think. And there's a lot more to explore. I think everything's been done with, like, rock music.
Uh-huh.
As far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, so, you can always do a reunion tour, but for me, there's not much else.
So, what kind of reaction have you gotten so far?
It was pretty good. They don't give as many hits as, say, like a King Kong song that already got released on a label that's on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
They'll get a lot more views on YouTube than my videos do.
Yeah.
Because I don't have any way, you know, I don't have a publicity thing. They're not known. I think I got the idea. One of our songs, Tornado Song, some guy made just a video, like a little, his own video for it.
Uh-huh.
But he just, you know, put other YouTube clips on a, and put it together with one of our songs. And it got like, it's already had like 70,000 views.
Wow.
And I thought, well, if he, that's still my song, and it's still called Tornado Song, and if he, what if I make my own videos? If that many people are interested in watching this video, and say my videos maybe like 2,000 views.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that song was already known because it got released and they have publicists and stuff at Drag City.
Right. Okay. Well, so what else, I mean, what do you think about, I mean, when you...
Plus I like, the other thing I think people crave action. When you see a band, you don't see a lot of action anymore.
Mm-hmm.
What you mostly see is like somebody standing there.
Right.
And I think people crave a lot of action and more visuals.
Yeah.
And I'm not talented enough to play guitar and like give them a whole lot of action.
Right.
So with the video, I can make up a lot of visuals, and it's really fun. So you mix, you know, and you mix the different endeavors together, because like a video is kind of like art.
Right.
And then you mix it with the music.
Yeah. No, that's cool. So, I mean, just, I wonder what your reflections are, I mean, on the whole, you know, do you think much about Louisville music and the time that you've been involved in it? I mean, what are the things that are really significant to you about it, would you say? It's a broad question, I realize.
I know. I think as a city, I think Louisville punches above its weight.
Mm-hmm.
I think people like Louisville's kind of people like the arts in Louisville, and so original bands got a lot of support in a place like Louisville.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe more so than even a bigger city would. So you get to have like Babylon Dance Band and Slint and Fading Out, some really good bands for like, you know, a city its size. I think it's pretty impressive, and I was always really impressed by that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then even more famous bands lately, like, what are they called?
My Morning Jacket.
And they're always, and Louisville's had like a pretty good run. Hound Mouth.
Right.
I forget the name of the other guy.
Well, and then I thought I saw you playing VHS or Beta. They kind of got big, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you lived right across the alley from us.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So I say Louisville punches above its weight for that.
All right.
But I was really impressed with all that stuff, you know, in the 80s.
Well, anything else about that? Anything else you just remember about the scene in general or the people you met? Or?
Well, I'll never forget seeing the first... Actually, I saw a punk band in Cincinnati when I was in eighth grade.
Uh-huh.
They're kind of like the Babylon Dance Band in Cincinnati.
Uh-huh.
Like a really popular band, and they were doing the pogo dance.
Okay.
That was really fun. I don't remember what they were called. But just I remember the way that people were dancing. And they would just dance with total abandon.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like being at a prom or a mixer.
Right.
It was something else.
Yeah. Okay. Let me just see if there's anything.
I really like the smallness of it, too.
How do you mean?
Well, you had a band, and then there was like 30 people watching the band. And I really like that, as opposed to going to some big event.
Just the intimacy of it, you mean?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And the participation level was like going and seeing a band at the state fair.
Right.
You know, that was my only experience of seeing a band, maybe.
Okay. Do you need to get that? Okay. Let's see what else. I don't know. We sort of talked about this, but do you have talking about Louisville punching above its weight. Was there anything else that contrasted it to the national scene at the time?
Well, when I used to live in Washington, D.C., they, you know, they had a much bigger scene than Louisville did, obviously.
Right.
Real influential. Trying to think, you know, and I go see shows in Cincinnati. Like I saw the Dead Kennedys in Cincinnati.
Uh-huh.
and they'd be playing both Friday and Saturday night, and it'd be 1,000 people there, and it'd be a huge, you know, it'd be a huge, exciting event. And there's nothing ever happened like that in Louisville.
Right, right.
But then I thought that Louisville had its own unique little scene, and maybe a like a much bigger city like Cincinnati didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was, you know, proud of Louisville and its little, and its little scene that had its own unique bands.
Right, right.
And it was, and it was very local. Like punk rock was very localized. Like everybody had their little, their local thing. And you read Maximum Rock and Roll, and it have a page for each,
right,
each city. You know, it's sort of fun.
Well, I mean, I think something always meant a lot.
When you're young, everybody wants to have an identity, right?
Right.
And if you're from Louisville, you wish that Louisville had like something like a good identity that you could be proud of, just like the way somebody would like a sports team or get a 502 tattoo or whatever.
Right, right. Well, and something I know always meant a lot to me, and I know, you know, you certainly have done some, is just the idea of, like, you know, just throwing local references into a song, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like the Tornado song or something like that.
Yeah, I try to do that. I try to, like, show off the fact that I was from Kentucky. Or I try to sing with a little Southern accent more.
Okay. Well, I don't know if there's anything else that you think is important to talk about.
And I thought Smoketown Red was, like, a really Louisville kind of person.
Yeah, yeah.
He wasn't just, like, he wasn't just anybody in his little scene. He had his own little special scene that kind of went, it kind of marched to its own little beat in the West End.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was real equivalent of like maybe the punk rock scene in the Highlands.
Okay, that's cool.
I mean, he had a style that was just unique to him. And when he played, you start dancing, and people had like a kind of dance that only he made you dance like that. You know, he really found the flow.
Great. All right, is there anything else that you think is important that we haven't touched on?
Well, I think for now, I think that's it.
Okay. All right. Man, I really, really want to thank you. Go ahead.